What is life? And in what sense or senses might the lives of human beings, their activities, or simply their presence, whether lively or quiescent, have a claim on our respect? The word life can refer to our whole lifespan. Life can be long or cut short. Or it can refer to our existence at any one moment. Life is good, or this patient is still alive. Then again, it can refer to spheres of life, that is, particular, often conscious, aspects of our lives, our work life or our family life. Of course, these spheres can then have a dignity of their own, over and above any dignity attached to our being here at all. However, the term life, when used simply on its own, often refers to our whole life, including when we are very young, asleep or very ill, or otherwise mentally hors de combat. Life normally involves a huge range of bodily activities, many of which remain quite unknown to us, and even perhaps to medical science. Note, however, that in some cases there may not be any activity going on, if we discount the activity of simply existing. There may be merely the tendency to act, as when a frozen embryo, perhaps in the future a frozen adult, is alive but halted in midstream, retaining the tendency to resume bodily activities if treated in a certain way. Life can be seen then as either the process of functioning as a whole, or as existence with the tendency to function, functionality, whether or not currently expressed. With all these senses of life, we are referring to bodily existence, the existence of the kind of beings we are, embodied beings, not disembodied ghosts. While the question of the soul and its survival after death and reunion, where the body is hardly irrelevant to human dignity, survival of a mere soul awaiting a body to inform it would not be life in the normal sense of the word. It is the earthly lives of whole bodily human beings or organisms that I want to consider in this lecture. And whatever the importance of the spiritual dimension for a fully adequate account of our life's dignity, I'll be offering more modest, secular type reflections, as befits a mere ethicist with a very atheological background. If life, for the purpose of this lecture, means either entire lifespan or existence at some perhaps unspecified time, what does dignity mean? Here again, there are various possible meanings, but I will use the term as a placeholder for whatever makes it morally appropriate to honour the subject of that dignity. Note that while dignity concerns morally appropriate honouring, the subject, him or herself, is often being honoured for something other than the person's moral virtue. While someone can certainly grow in moral dignity, acquired dignity, demanding its own respect, the sense of dignity I want to discuss is mostly the inherent dignity which can be ascribed to the kind of being we are. Such dignity arguably grounds our moral need to make choices that befit that kind of being. Many of us subscribe to some notion of human equality, believing that human beings are equal in some sense, not in their abilities or attainments, but at least in certain basic human rights. If we believe this, we need a sense of human dignity which will attach to everyone, even very evil people, who do not lose their human rights or turn into some lesser, subhuman or subpersonal kind of being. For that matter, our own activities in practice, as opposed to our orientation to more admirable activities, are not always something to be proud of, as we know all too well. It is what I'm oriented towards, not how I behave in fact, which gives me my basic inherent dignity, as opposed to any acquired dignity. Bearing in mind that however special a kind of being we are, and we are indeed very special, many of our activities are rather mundane and or flawed, morally or otherwise. The word undignified is a somewhat lesser word than either dignity or indignity. Sometimes we look or feel undignified in ways not directly related to our moral choices or those of others, even if our shame or embarrassment does have something to do with the imagined or actual presence of other people. Loss of control over bodily functions would be one obvious example. The shame or embarrassment we feel may be no one's fault and not particularly a moral issue, unless by that we simply mean, for example, that others should respond to our predicament with kindness and tact. Different societies will have different ways of doing this, just as they and the individuals in them will see different situations as undignified. Other times, however, shame attaches to our choices, which either in reality or in others' perception are unbefitting in some moral sense. The danger then is that any shame felt by us or others can elicit a radical turning away from what our dignity requires, even in the most extreme cases, turning us or others against our very lives. We see this with honour killings and suicides in relation to scandals of some kind, whether criminal behaviour on the person's part, such as child abuse, or non-criminal but still seriously wrong behaviour, such as extramarital affairs. Of course, the dignity of the person is far better served by facing some degree of shame and or punishment where necessary, rather than being pushed into death, whether it was at one's own hand or that of angry relatives or mobs. This may sound remote from Ireland or the UK, but in Western countries too, feelings of shame and fear can trigger a life-ending response, normally in the West involving an unborn child whom a girl or woman feels driven to abort. One moral indignity, such as sexual exploitation, consensual or otherwise, can lead to another, even if the woman knows, despite her desperation, that this is not what dignity requires. Moral indignities inflicted by others come in many forms, bearing in mind that we can also be mistaken sometimes in feeling disrespected. Note that the fact that I can experience genuine dignities and behave in a morally unfitting way myself is in reality a sign of my underlying inherent dignity, which is being dishonoured. This also applies to situations where other people are not so much hostile as indifferent to us, or at least to something about us which is important and deserves more consideration. Nor does it seem that indignity requires perception of indignity by those who suffer it, or even the ability to perceive indignity. The indignities we condemn in the treatment of elderly people with dementia, for example, are a sign that despite their cognitive problems, they have dignity which is being violated. As Alexander Pruss points out, it is no indignity for a rock to have mud poured over it. Making fun of a monkey does not harm the monkey. Moreover, only a being with great dignity can suffer a great indignity. Thus, that some beings suffer horrendous indignities entails that these beings have great dignity. Note that indignities can be agreed to by the person in advance. Some ethicists claim that permanently unconscious people might volunteer in advance to be used in dangerous non-therapeutic experiments, while one author suggests that women might volunteer to be surrogate mothers of other people's children should they fall into an unconscious state. If a living human being has inherent moral dignity, then surely such actions will violate that dignity, despite being carried out with the subject's complicity and prior consent. Our inherent dignity and what violates it is not up to us to determine, any more than it is up to other people. Moreover, indignities we request or tolerate can have serious effects on those in a similar condition to our own. We'll come back to this later on. Even apart from the context of physician-assisted death, where people often speak of death with dignity, questions of dignity often arise in relation to end-of-life care, often care of the very elderly. Less often, end-of-life care will be perinatal care of babies diagnosed prenatally as having a life-limiting condition. Here again, terms like dignity or related terms like honour and respect may be used by parents of their living babies as they continue with the pregnancy. Thus, one woman describes her devastation at hearing her baby's prenatal test result, followed immediately by the offer of abortion. "I felt," she says, "as though no one in the medical profession valued our baby because of her genetic makeup. I wanted to love and honour the life of our little girl, and I wanted everyone else to do so too. It is striking that parents who choose abortion in these circumstances, when they use the word honour, tend to do so in relation to the baby's remains or memory, or perhaps the baby's spirit, not the living baby remembered while she was still alive. The child scheduled for abortion may be loved while still alive, but we must ask, is her dignity respected and is her bodily being truly appreciated? These are painful questions, but for love to be fully respectful and unsentimental, there must be full appreciation of the loved one's presence. Not just a desire, perhaps, to confer some benefit on the loved one, in this case, the perceived benefit of death. The significantly worse emotional effect on women of abortion, as opposed to giving birth in these harrowing circumstances, may suggest that wanting to honour your child in death is no substitute for knowing you honoured in every way her presence during life. The remarks of another mother who took to term a baby with a life-limiting condition also suggests that value is being used in a different sense, a sense more like inherent dignity, from the sense in which life's value would appear to be variable and incremental. Susan says of her son Frankie, "All of us have an inevitable death in the offing. Frankie was no different from the rest of us. We began to see that we could not measure the value of our baby's life in terms of years or even months or days." Yet again, the mother of another child, Corinne, had this to say. "We were transformed by the experience of embracing life without putting expectations or limits on her value. Our devotion to a child who was brought into this world not because of what she could do for us, but for the dignity she brought simply as a human being, a member of our family, emphasised to our other children their own worth. They know now more concretely the unconditional love we have for each of them, and that their worth is not predicated by their looks or accomplishments." Often when we talk about the value or worth of life, we are really talking about life's inherent dignity, a dignity which is non-incremental and, in a sense, timeless, in contrast to the fluctuating incremental value of our lives, as they are longer or shorter and more or less flourishing. Life is no different from other human goods or aspects of human fulfillment, in that we can have more or less of it, more or less life, as we might have more or less friendship, say, or more or less knowledge. There is no problem with saying that 30 more years of life are in themselves more valuable for me than 3 minutes more of life, or even with saying that those 30 years are worth more to me in themselves if I'm healthy rather than ill. Note that I'm speaking here of the good of life and health, not of the social or spiritual sense in which sometimes more of importance can be achieved in 3 minutes, perhaps on our very deathbed, than we may have achieved in the past 30 years. There is also a real sense in which my life as a developed adult is worth more to me immediately than my life as a five-year-old child, even though as a five-year-old child I had a long-term interest in developing those more mature capacities, projects and relationships. However, when it comes to the inherent dignity of life, if any such exists, then 3 minutes, 3 years or even 30 years of life cannot add to or subtract from this dignity in any way. Morally, I matter in my very being, and this applies to every minute and every second, just as I am no more or less a human being if I have a minute or second more to live. What might this inherent dignity be, though? We need to remember that even the youngest and most disabled human being is a member of the human kind, a special rational kind, different from any other kind of animal we know. His or her body is oriented to rational fulfillment, even if such fulfillment will be unattainable for all of his or her earthly life. Even a baby missing much of her brain is missing that part because that part is one she should have, as other parts testify. For example, her lower brain, which ought to support the missing part, or indeed her vocal cords, which ought to help her speak when she's old enough to do so. A dying baby is no less a rational kind of being for the fact she's too sick to grow up to think just as she is no less a mammal for the fact she is too sick to feed from her mother, or grow up and perhaps feed a baby of her own. We differ in many ways. However, we're all the same kind of being who could in theory be fulfilled in the same basic ways, and whose fulfillment is always morally important as the same fulfillment in the life of one and the same living being. The value and dignity of human life cannot be demoted by disease to the value of the life of a lower animal. Human beings have interests, after all, in human goods, a far richer range of goods than non-rational animals. When things go badly for us, there is more of which we are deprived, more value missing, for the very reason that there is also more value present in the orientation to rationality which we always possess. We cannot speak of health or sickness at all without identifying the kind of being whose flourishing depends on certain features. Health and sickness are value-laden terms, and there is nothing wrong with that. We do not let disease define the person, but rather it is by looking at the person and how he or she ought to be functioning to achieve good outcomes that we identify the disease and know how to treat it, or whether it can be treated at all. This is also true for non-human animals, of course, but while it is a pity that some seagulls cannot fly, it calls for a deeper response if a being who should be able to think is seriously injured in that or in some other way. We can value animals' lives and their health without denying the very obvious chain of being, where humans, at least in this world, are surely at the top of that chain, and seagulls far below. If we respect and even love our fellow human beings, we should appreciate them in a special way. And so, I'm claiming, want them to exist in a particularly strong sense as irreplaceable beings. Respect for someone is significantly dented by a failure to value that person's very existence, whatever genuine respect and goodwill is shown by wanting the person's life to go well. As Stephen Brock observes, it would be a mistake to think that in wanting good for some being, what is wanted must always be other than the being that it is wanted for. In loving a friend, one does not just want other goods to exist for him. One surely also wants him to exist for him. One wants his well-being. A necessary element of this is his simply being. The object of love of friendship as such is not only a being for which good is wanted, but also a good that is wanted for itself. Very much part of loving someone is or should be the thought, it is good that you exist. Nor need this, of course, be linked to any beneficent action on the part of the one who loves, who may rather be contemplating and appreciating the sheer presence of the person loved without contemplating any particular way of treating them. If someone's human dignity must always be acknowledged, is that ever compatible with, and even evidenced by, the deliberate ending of life? Some would say yes, including Elizabeth Anscombe, who sees some, though not other, forms of capital punishment as compatible with respect for human dignity as the person is treated as a rational being who is responsible for his or her actions. Whatever our view of capital punishment as a last resort, perhaps, in some conceivable society, it is much less plausible to argue that dignity could ever be respected by ending a life seen as falling below a certain standard of health, or even simply as obstructing the interests or perceived interests of others. Certainly, no one should be killed, not as a current aggressor or someone who deserves punishment for a past crime, but simply because they are in our way, and or their death can serve our ends. To treat someone simply as an obstacle to our plans, for example, and deliberately end his or her life for that reason, is not to treat the person or the person's life as having human dignity. And as regards the value of life as opposed to the utility of death to other people, even with convicted criminals, no one should try to argue that a criminal's life has no value. A society troubled enough to want to execute its criminals needs to find a better argument than that. In contrast with euthanasia, the message may indeed be that life has no value or dignity of a kind that would preclude the deliberate taking of that life, at least if this has been requested. One conundrum for countries where euthanasia can be requested in advance of loss of mental capacity is what to say about the elderly person who now has dementia but seems quite contented. Should such a person be killed merely because he or she requested it earlier, no doubt on the basis that life with dementia was seen as an indignity? If society carries out choices made, perhaps quite explicitly, on the grounds that life has no dignity in such conditions, is not society seeming at least to endorse that view of the person's life? And what does such endorsement or seeming endorsement say about the dignity of others living with dementia? A similar argument can be made about conditions where the person is mentally competent and expects to remain so, but recoils at dependency or being a burden. What message does it give to carry out that choice, but not the choice of suicidal teenagers, say, where the message given is rather that their lives have value despite how they themselves view their lives? As David Jones has said, the very act of judging life with impairment as a life unworthy to be lived is discriminatory and humiliating to those who live with impairment. To say that one wants to die with dignity is to say that life in certain conditions is an indignity, and that has very serious implications for the lives of others who live with that condition and should not hear, and nor should their loved ones hear, that their very existence lacks dignity. Yes, aspects of one's medical care may be undignified in the trivial sense I mentioned earlier, and one may feel them as an indignity, at least in anticipation. However, to say that those aspects and the very life they support are an indignity is in fact an insult, however unintended, to other dependent people with that very condition. While voluntary euthanasia can and does lead to non-voluntary euthanasia, in some ways voluntary euthanasia is worse in that the patient is also failing to value and respect his or her life, and by implication the lives of others similarly placed. Nothing about us makes us infallible guides on the value and dignity of our lives, or indeed on other aspects of our welfare. If I say that friends are unimportant and money is all that counts, my opinion is one thing, reality is another. Just as I can disrespect friendship or knowledge, I can disrespect the value and dignity of my life, whether now, because I see current dependency as an indignity, or in some imagined future, because I see future dependency and perhaps cognitive impairment as an indignity. Of course, many will claim that appeals to the dignity of life and need to give way to appeals to the dignity of autonomous choice. And indeed, in some areas, we can all think of cases where those around us and the state do need to step back and allow us to make our own mistakes. However, there are some ways of harming ourselves and others with regard to which no state can afford to remain passive, let alone become involved in itself. Homicide and assisted suicide are paradigmatic cases of where the law does need to get involved. That includes when people are killed for their own sake, because they want this, and or because, in their view, their life has no dignity. We might ask, is this any less a failure of respect than acting out the prior wishes of those who want to let themselves be used in lethal research? Or perhaps to train medical students in surgical techniques? Is it any less harmful or demoralising to society, given that many more people want to kill themselves for whatever reason than want to be used in lethal experiments? Not to mention those likely to be killed without request, where euthanasia is legalised. It is worth remembering that even our legitimate concern to respect people's preferences where possible has its origin not in the preferences themselves, but in the human beings who have them. People are more than their preferences, which can be unworthy of them to form and unworthy of us to endorse, even in those kinds of cases where we do need to step aside. The faculty of choosing, like all our other faculties, is supposed to be for good ends, so we can freely pursue the good. Choices should respect oneself and others, and there are limits to the leeway society should allow people to choose in ways that show, whatever the good faith of those who make these choices, especially serious and even contagious disrespect. Even if some latitude must be allowed in the service of privacy and freedom to choose well under pressure, whether that applies to a particular kind of choice depends entirely on what is being chosen. All that said, there are many ways in which respect for the dignity of life is misunderstood and also deliberately caricatured, both as regards end-of-life situations and as regards refusal of treatment during pregnancy. Respect for the dignity of life does not mean vitalism, taking all conceivable means to prolong or protect life. There are many reasons to refrain from life-prolonging interventions, whether because these are rejected by a competent patient who has first responsibility for his or her own health, or simply because the burdens they create for the patient are unwarranted by any slight benefits they may achieve. Respect for the dignity of life means, above all, refraining from deliberate attacks on life, including deliberate attacks by omission, where there is no question of crime or attacks on other people on the part of the individual killed. Similarly with pregnancy, respect for the dignity of life, applying simultaneously to two separate, though intimately linked, living beings, does not require promoting at any cost the perceived health interests of either the woman or her baby. We might think of caesareans, which might be refused by a woman confronting a difficult labour. Whether she is right or wrong to refuse in a particular case, her guardianship over her baby and also over her own body that would be invaded certainly extends this far. Other interventions might be refused by the woman and or by the doctor because those interventions are judged by one or both to be wrong in themselves. For example, a woman carrying triplets or quadruplets might refuse a lethal injection for one or more of the babies she is carrying, so-called pregnancy reduction. She might refuse this even to promote the safe delivery of her other babies, and even if this would also safeguard her own health, which might be threatened by multiple pregnancy. Pregnancy is a human relationship, not a relationship between two things or a person and a thing. Just as the woman should not be reduced to a carrier, she is a pregnant mother, not a subhuman object, so her baby or babies should not be reduced to carried contents of the womb or products of her own conception. The dignity of the woman's life, her child's life, and their pregnancy relationship demands very serious respect. The woman's special guardianship of her baby, as well as her own separate body, should certainly be recognised in cases where she competently refuses interventions, whether rightly or wrongly. When it comes to requesting interventions, however, we are in a very different situation. Requesting necessary treatment, such as cancer treatment, is one thing. Requesting unnecessarily and seriously harmful interventions is another. Even if the woman intends no harm at all to her baby or her pregnancy, as normally she will not, she may not, for example, demand thalidomide for morning sickness, simply because she has some right to unrestricted bodily control. And if that is so, how much less may she demand an intervention like abortion that actually focuses harmfully on her baby and does not just affect the baby in a wholly unintended way? The dignity of life should be a matter of second nature, producing some degree of awe in us that protects us from temptations to take life unjustly or helps us resist these if they arise. Beginning in our own minds, there is an onus on us not to think of each other's existence, or rather to think of each other's existence in respectful terms, or at very least not in disrespectful terms. In the practical arena, we respect the dignity of life by stepping back. This is about choices we should not make in the first instance, rather than about choices we should. choices to end life or to carry out deliberate bodily assaults on an innocent human being are choices to avoid. Whether the individual assaulted is a suicidal elderly person, a pregnant woman, or the baby she is carrying. That said, when all such negative duties have been respected, there are many strong, if contingent, positive duties to support life. And going beyond duty, there are many further positive opportunities to promote the life and health of old and frail and disabled people and pregnant women and babies, whether these are members of our own families or of the wider family from which we all come. It may be true that the only absolute implications of the dignity of human life are negative, but a world in which only such negative implications were recognised would be a poor world indeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the Society for inviting me here this evening to respond to Dr. Watt's paper, which I found very informative and enlightening and thought-provoking. I'm going to use my response, though, not to challenge anything she said, because there's nothing in her paper with which I disagree, but rather I thought I might usefully use my few minutes speaking to you to examine and defend an implicit assumption in her paper, namely that life from its very earliest stages has its own dignity that makes a claim on our respect. And this is a question I think that has a relevance obviously to the discussion we're having in this country at the moment in relation to abortion. Now, this is a philosophical question, a political question, and I'm neither a philosopher nor a politician, so you know, I give you that sort of warning in advance. But it's a question that I did find myself having to address back in 2004, 2005. I was a member then of the Commission on Assisted Human Reproduction, and one of the issues that we had to address in that work was the whether or not it would be licit or legitimate to experiment on embryos. Just the context here, of course, is in vitro fertilization, where as a result of scientific developments in the 1970s, 1980s, it became possible to fertilize human eggs outside of the womb and then to implant those in vitro embryos into the womb and hope for a successful pregnancy. Now, that technique inevitably resulted in the generation of surplus embryos. And then the question arose, well, what to do with these surplus embryos? Do we just keep them indefinitely? Or, given the scientific benefits that we could derive from using embryonic stem cells, could we destroy the embryos in pursuit of scientific knowledge and in particular in pursuit of improvement in our knowledge of medicine that would address serious illnesses? I found myself in a minority of one in the commission in opposing the majority offered various arguments as to why it would be morally appropriate to experiment in the way that I've described on in vitro embryos. Okay, so what we're dealing with here now, just again to recap, this is the fertilized egg. The process of fertilization has taken place and the embryo is now placed in suspended animation. It's frozen. And so the argument here was that life at this early stage was not deserving of the same level of respect as life at various later stages in development. And as I say, the commission or the majority put forward various arguments to justify this distinction or differentiation. Now, the first thing that struck me was that it was interesting that they put forward various arguments, because that in itself pointed to what I consider to be a weakness in their position. If there was one very strong, compelling argument justifying this distinction. That argument would you know, sweep the table. It would be the only argument to advance. But in fact, each of the different arguments that were put forward to me had problems. And a cluster of weak arguments does not one strong argument make. I mean, we're dealing here with, you know, the same principle that the weakest, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and if you've got a series of weak arguments, they will not constitute a strong argument for your position. But what were the various arguments put forward? Well, the first stage of development that was focused on and that was offered as a possible important marker differentiating early life from later life was implantation. So the suggestion was that prior to implantation, it would be okay to dispose of embryos, pre-implanted embryos, that they didn't have a dignity that warranted protection. And in that context, it was pointed out that in nature, many pre-implanted embryos are lost. They fail to implant, that there's a high level of wastage just in nature. Now, the difficulty with that argument, of course, is that that's what's known as a naturalistic fallacy. You cannot argue from the position that something happens naturally in nature and that therefore justifies deliberate action on the part of humans. In some societies, for example, there might be a relatively high infant mortality rate for infants under the age of 6 months. That would never justify anyone in deliberately killing an infant under the age of 6 months. And by the same parity of reason, I didn't think that argument justified the deliberate destruction of the embryo. It was also pointed out, next argument, that it would be okay to experiment on embryos up to the 9th day of development. Now, what's the significance of the 9th day of development? Well, the argument here was that when you get to the 9th day of development, from that point on, you no longer have the possibility of twinning. In other words, when you have an embryo from day one, between day one and day 8, I guess, the possibility remains that it could spontaneously split, and instead of having one individual, you'd have two individuals, okay? And so the suggestion was that at this early stage, we're not dealing with an individual, potentially we're dealing with two, and if we're not dealing with one individual, then it's not individual life. Well, the problems with this argument were, first of all, that this type of twinning occurs in 0.4% of cases. I think I've got my figures, 0.4% of cases. So 4 in every 1,000 cases. We don't make general rules that would apply to the general populace by reference to the very specific circumstances of a small number of people. So that's the first point to note. The very vast majority of fertilized embryos are individual from the get-go and remain individual throughout. Second problem here was that if I'm concerned about the destruction of an individual human life that would make a unique contribution, would have a unique relationship with other humans, it doesn't allay my concern to tell me that what I'm destroying is potentially two individual lives. In fact, it simply enhances the concerns I have that this is an even greater problem than heretofore. Those were the two particular objections I had to that particular argument. The third argument, penultimate argument here, was the suggestion that 14 days would be significant, because at the 14th day, approximately 14 days after fertilization, you have the emergence of brain activity on the part of the embryo. So prior to that time, there's no what's known as the primitive streak has not appeared. And the argument is that brain activity is an essential component of human life and human existence. At the other end of life, when brain activity ceases, you are dead. You've ceased to exist. And so the analogy was drawn between no brain activity at the early stage of life, with the absence of brain activity at the later stage of life, at the point of death, the suggestion being that this pre-primitive streak life was not the same as life in its later stages. Well, the analogy is a false one, because there is a difference between pre-primitive streak early life and life at the later stage where brain activity has ceased. At the later end, at the end of life, when brain activity ceases, it ceases and is gone. It is not going to come back. Whereas the pre-14-day fertilized embryo, brain activity in the normal course of events will happen. There is that difference. It's not the absence of brain activity that defines death, it's the permanent absence of brain activity that defines death. If you imagine, just for a moment, if we imagine some sort of scientific advance which results in the creation of a cerebral defibrillator, we're all familiar with defibrillators used to revive someone who suffered a heart attack. Imagine if we had something comparable to revive a person whose brain activity had ceased. I think most of us would feel we should use that type of defibrillator to try and bring back life, at least in cases where the life would have a value. We wouldn't simply say, "Oh, life, the brain activity has ceased, and therefore there's nothing to be done." So it's not the absence of brain activity; it's the permanent absence of brain activity. And for the pre-14-day embryo, there is no permanent absence of brain activity. You simply have to wait. And the primitive streak will emerge. And finally then, there was the argument that protection, legal protection for the embryo should develop on an incremental basis, and that as the period, say, of pregnancy increases, as the gestation goes on, that increasingly more and more respect should be paid to the unborn until you get to a certain point where you would accept that they had a right to life. My difficulty here is that this approach is rather imprecise. It doesn't offer us very clear guidance on when life should be protected. And that's unlike our approach to life after birth. None of us would like the notion of there being imprecision as to whether or not I enjoy the right to life. We would like to be assured that there's very cogent, compelling protection, except, say, in the extreme circumstance of where you might be threatening somebody else's life, where the law recognises a right of self-defence. But short of that, I don't think we would like to be operating in a society where there might be any ambiguity or vagueness about when we enjoy the right to life. And yet, this approach carries that danger or difficulty when it comes to preborn life. It implies, if you follow it through to its logical conclusion, it actually may imply that the event of birth itself might not be a significant marker in relation to legal protection for life, because a premature baby is less developed than a baby that's born at full term. Does that mean that the baby still in the womb, who's gone beyond the 30 weeks or whatever, does that mean that it doesn't enjoy full protection for the right to life? Simply because it's still developing. The logical implication of this approach was sort of graphically illustrated by one American philosopher, Peter Singer, who defends, as I understand it, the proposition that even where a baby has been born, that there's no moral objection to infanticide, provided the baby's parents do not object. Singer carries that argument about developmental improvement or increases in protection for life through birth and beyond. And he considers that the early, the newly born infant does not enjoy the same, or should not enjoy the same legal protection as a child who has developed further. And that just shows, for me, the dangers of that particular approach. In that context, people talked about, you know, personhood, acquiring personhood, and that what the law should protect is personhood. But again, there's a problem here. How do you define personhood? It seemed to me that some definitions of personhood could be such as to exclude from legal protection lives that we considered, we currently consider to be protected. For example, I came across one description of personhood, or indicators of humanhood, as it was put, which identified the following as characteristics of personhood: self-awareness, self-control, a sense of the future, a sense of the past, the capacity to relate to others, concern for others, communication and curiosity. Well, if you take those factors, if all of those factors constitute personhood, then anybody who lacks any of those factors is not a person and may not be entitled to the protection of the law. And yet, when you think about some of those factors, they're absent in some people. Say, for example, people with dementia who may have no sense of the future, no sense of the past. Does that mean that they are not persons, that they don't deserve the protection that the rest of us enjoy? So these were the problems that I was left with in relation to this particular issue, which led me to conclude and to dissent from my colleagues and argue that dignity applies to life really once life commences, and that any action that would end that life really is to be resisted. In the absence, of the life in question posing a threat to some other life. I mean, self-defence is obviously a factor, but absent that, I think there was. That's why I found great difficulty, to the point where I dissented from endorsing the majority recommendations on the disposition of in vitro embryos. So I thought that I think is implicit in Dr. Watts's paper, but I just thought I might just tease out that issue because, as I say, I think it might have some relevance to the discussion we're having today. So thank you.